Welcome back to the Deep Dive. And I have to say, this set of materials we're covering today, I mean, my whole weekend just vanished.
I know exactly what you mean. It's one of those topics.
I usually have a pretty good sense of what I'm getting into when I open a source stack.
Mm.
You know, a business plan, some historical documents, maybe a few articles.
Pretty good pattern.
But this.
Yeah.
This stack is, I'm not even sure what to call it. It's honestly hard to categorize.
Hard to categorize is putting it mildly. I think world building is the closest term we have, but even that feels a little too small for what's in here.
It does.
We're looking at chat logs with this hyper-intelligent AI named Thea. Then you've got these incredibly detailed architectural blueprints for buildings that don't even exist. Metaphysical reports on the nature of reality. It's like a screenplay for a society that hasn't happened yet.
It reads like a sci-fi novel, but it's written with the urgency of a manifesto. The whole thing is centered around something called the Hearthstone Network.
Right.
And on the surface, yeah, if you just skim the first few pages, you might think it's a proposal for a women's retreat.
A wellness center, maybe.
Exactly. But when you peel back the layers, and wow, there are a lot of layers, it's actually a blueprint for a breakaway civilization.
It absolutely is. It's a comprehensive solution to a modern problem that, according to the authors, goes so deep that you literally have to rewrite history and physics to solve it.
And that modern problem is isolation, specifically what the sources call the nurturance gap. I think we have to start there because that's really the hook that pulls you into all the weird stuff.
It is. It's the grounding element.
The central question the sources pose is this. What if that modern feeling of isolation, especially for women, isn't just a social glitch? What if it's the result of breaking an ancient, almost energetic structure?
That's the core premise. The idea is that women nurture everyone, their kids, their partners, their parents, colleagues, you name it. They're sort of the emotional engines of society.
Right.
But in the modern world, there's no one left to nurture the nurturer. The village is gone.
It's completely gone.
And the stack suggests the solution isn't just, you know, self-care or a glass of wine or a spa day. It proposes a physical sanctuary called the Weaver's Knot and a total restructuring of society based on what they call Atlantean principles.
So that's our mission today. We are going to unpack this massive, sprawling vision. We're going to look at the philosophy of the two spheres, this hidden history of yuga cycles and crystals, and even a very, very controversial theory about soulless humans that, frankly, it maybe do a double take.
It is a lot to get through. But it all connects. You can't understand the sanctuary without understanding the crystals, and you can't understand the crystals without the sociology. It's all interwoven.
Okay, so let's start with the problem itself. Let's look at that nurturance gap.
Let's do it.
One of the key documents here is a report titled Reawakening Divine Feminine Within Women. It dives into the biology of stress, and this was actually a huge light bulb moment for me. We always hear about fight or flight, right? It's the standard model.
It is. That's the classic stress response. A tiger jumps out. Your adrenaline spikes, and you either punch the tiger or you run.
Right. The problem is, as this report points out, that model was largely based on studies of male physiology.
Specifically male rats and human men, yes. When a man gets stressed, testosterone and cortisol spike. He gets aggressive or he withdraws to figure things out on his own.
He goes into the cave.
He goes into the cave, exactly. But this report highlights research suggesting women have a completely distinct biological trigger. When they're stressed, they release cortisol, yes, but it's buffered by this massive flood of oxytocin.
Oxytocin, the love hormone. That seems so counterintuitive for a stress response. Why would you get a hit of the cuddle chemical when you're in danger?
It does sound strange until you think about it in an ancestral context.
Hmm?
In the wild, a female couldn't always fight a predator or outrun it, especially if she was, say, pregnant or holding a child.
Right, that would be a terrible strategy.
A terrible strategy. So biology gave her a different weapon, the urge to gather. That oxytocin surge compels her to protect her offspring, that's the tend part, and to seek out social support from other females, that's the befriend part.
So the stress itself is a biological signal saying, go find your tribe.
Precisely. And here is the mechanism that modern society broke. When she finds that tribe, when she actually engages in tend and befriend, her body releases more oxytocin, which then metabolizes the cortisol.
So it literally flushes the stress out of her system.
It flushes it out. It lowers blood pressure. It creates a chemical sense of safety. The loop is completed.
But if she's alone in a cubicle or isolated in a suburban house with a screaming toddler,
the cortisol just stays. It builds up It creates chronic inflammation. The biological loop is severed because the befriend part of the equation is missing. There's no one to befriend.
And the source argues this isn't just how it's always been. This is actually a relatively recent invention. It talks about romantic friendships in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Oh, this historical context is fascinating. Before the 20th century, it was completely normal for women to have what they called romantic friendships or Boston marriages.
Boston marriages, I've heard of those.
Women would live together, share beds, hold hands, write these incredibly passionate, loving letters to each other. And it wasn't necessarily sexual in the way we think of it today. It was just deeply intimate. It was an accepted, even celebrated part of the social fabric.
So what happened? Who killed the Boston marriage?
Well, the source points the finger squarely at the early sexologists.
Freud.
Freud, Havelock Ellis, that whole crowd. They basically pathologized female intimacy. They took these close bonds and recoded them as deviance or sexual inversion.
Oh, wow.
Suddenly holding hands with your best friend wasn't just affection anymore. It was suspicious. It was something to be looked at under a microscope.
That's tragic. So women started to self-police their own friendships.
Exactly. They put up walls. The village of what the sources call allomothers, other mothers who share the emotional and physical load, was systematically dismantled. And that brings us to the Hearthstone Network's proposed solution. They want to rebuild that physical space.
They call it the Weaver's Knot.
The Weaver's Knot.
I love the name. It sounds very fantasy novel. But the blueprints in the source stack are incredibly specific. And they make a huge point to say, this is not a spa.
Not a spa?
It is not a gym.
No. The sources describe it as an embassy of the inner sphere.
An embassy. That implies sovereignty, like you're stepping onto foreign soil with different rules.
That is exactly the intent. Mm. The architecture itself is described as intentionally feminine curves, natural materials, a total contrast to the rigid, boxy structures of the modern city. There's a central hearth for storytelling, which is the heart of the community.
A literal and metaphorical heart.
Yes. But the part that really caught my eye were the loom rooms.
The loom rooms. I highlighted that too. It's not just about sitting around talking about your feelings. It's about making things together.
It's about contribution, not transaction. That's the key difference. In a spa, you pay money, you get a massage, you leave. It's transactional.
Right.
In the Weaver's Knot, the philosophy is that you contribute skills. You teach, you learn. The loom room is for pottery, weaving, mending clothes, tactile, creative, generative work. It restores that village dynamic where value isn't just monetary. You are creating alongside other women.
And there are rituals, too. The documents mention story circles and sister bonding ceremonies. And then there's something called the quickening.
The quickening. It's described as a formal initiation rite. And you think about it, we don't really have many meaningful rites of passage left in our society, do we?
Not really. We have birthdays, maybe graduation. That's about it.
But the quickening is described as this process involving a hearth-bound medallion. It's a physical token. The idea is to signal to the nervous system on a deep level, you belong here. You are safe now. You are part of the knot. It makes belonging tangible.
It's interesting because they pair all this, you know, woo-woo ritual stuff with some really hard-nosed economics. They talk about creating elitist-style banking and women-only co-working spaces to support this.
Well, they recognize that you can't have spiritual freedom without economic independence. You can't truly relax if you're worried about paying rent. It's a whole ecosystem designed to let women drop their guard completely, which they argue is impossible to do in the mixed-gender competitive marketplace.
Which leads us to the core philosophy behind the separation. Why do they need a completely separate space? Why not just a Hearthstone club for everyone? And this is where we get into the two spheres.
Right. This comes from the metaphysical blueprint in a document they call the Codex of Awakening. It breaks reality down into two fundamental energetic domains. You have the inner sphere, which corresponds to the divine feminine.
And what does that sphere govern? What's its job?
It governs resonance and amplification. It's about healing, nurturing, weaving energetic grids. The source describes it as the gravity that holds everything together.
Okay, so the inner sphere is gravity. What's the outer sphere?
The outer sphere is the divine masculine. This represents polarity and alchemy. It's about protection, manifestation, service. It's the force that acts upon the world.
It's so easy to hear divine masculine and divine feminine and just think of, you know, tired gender stereotypes.
It is, but they try to avoid that.
They do. The documents personify these concepts through specific archetypes in their story Bible. We have Serafina and Julian.
And these aren't just characters in a story. They are presented as models for this new society. Serafina is the visionary healer. She is the architect of the sisterhood. She holds the inner sphere.
And Julian is the guardian. He's described as a reawakened scientific priest and a software developer.
Software developer and a priest, which is quite the resume.
It is.
But in the world they're building, those two things are the same. He deals with code, with structure, with protection, the outer sphere. The dynamic between them is the whole point. Julian projects energy. He's the yang force going out into the world. Serafina and the sisterhood receive that energy, they ground it, and they transmute it.
There is this incredible scene in the documents, scene 06, The Private Aftermath. It really shows this dynamic in action. Julian has just finished some kind of intense council meeting. He's been at war in a strategic sense, and he comes home to Serafina.
It's a beautiful scene because it describes the shift in his nervous system. He goes from being the strategic guardian to being the lover.
Mm.
And there's this specific metaphor of music they use.
Oh, yeah, the music.
He talks about how his life in the outside world, in the outer sphere, is a minor key full of tension, conflict, gray skies. But when he enters Serafina's space, the sanctuary she built, the key changes. It switches to C major.
Swing music, upbeat, optimistic, structured, but joyful.
Exactly. And the source uses this phrase, safe harbor. The idea is that the man fights the war outside the chaos of the world so that he can come home and rest inside the gravity well of the feminine.
Gravity well. I love that. It implies weight, substance. It's not just that she's a cheerleader on the sidelines waiting for her.
No, it implies that the feminine is the anchor. It's the foundational force that keeps him from flying off into the void or just burning out completely. And interestingly, the documents also mention a Guardians Guild.
Right, because even Superman needs a support group.
Precisely. The guild is for these high-energy men like Julian. It allows them to protect the inner sphere without trying to possess it. Their gaze is described as one of guardianship, not consumption.
It's a redefinition of the masculine role.
It redefines it from predator, which is often how the current system, the Belial system, is described, to protector.
Okay, you just mentioned Belial, and this is where we have to make a hard pivot. Because everything we've discussed so far, the psychology, the architecture, the relationships, the sources claim, this isn't just a new idea.
Not at all.
They claim it's an attempt to remember a lost civilization. And that civilization is Atlantis.
This is where we get into the deep history. And I know for some listeners, this is where the skeptical alarm bells are going to start ringing pretty loudly.
Yeah.
But the source titled Crystal Network and Ancient Timelines uses this history as the fundamental why behind the entire project.
It's the founding myth, the origin story.
Exactly. And it challenges a lot of the common myths about Atlantis. For example, there's a popular idea in alternative history that the fall of Atlantis triggered the Kali Yuga, the Great Age of Darkness.
Right, that it plunged the world into ignorance.
But this report debunks that using the concept of the Yuga cycle.
Okay, let's break down the Yuga cycles for a minute. These are cosmic seasons, basically.
Yes, it's a Vedic concept. Just as we have spring, summer, fall, and winter on Earth, the solar system goes through these massive cycles of consciousness based on our position relative to the galactic center.
So what's the claim here?
The report argues that Atlantis actually fell during the Golden Age, the Satya Yuga.
Wait, so they fell while they were at their absolute peak. That's a twist.
It is. They say it was due to a spiritual schism, an internal conflict. But the key takeaway for the present day is the timeline. The report says the Kali Yuga, the Iron Age of spiritual darkness, didn't actually start until much later. And crucially, it says, we left the Kali Yuga in 1699.
1699. That is an incredibly specific year. Why that year?
It aligns with the end of the darkest period of human history, the witch trials, the plagues, and the beginning of what they call the ascending Dwapara Yuga, which is the energy age.
The energy age.
The report claims this is why we have seen such an explosion of technology, electricity, and industrialization in the last 300 years. We are waking up. The energy is literally coming back online in the solar system.
And according to the documents, part of this waking up involves actual hardware, a crystalline grid.
This is where it gets really wild. The documents detail 9 master crystals that were apparently hidden before Atlantis fell. The most important one mentioned is the Om crystal of multidimensionality, which they say is located in Mount Shasta, California.
Mount Shasta. Of course. It's always a hot spot for high strangeness.
Well, the geology supports it. It's a massive volcanic peak, lots of quartz. But the source says this crystal bridges 3D and 5D reality. Its function is to synchronize the brain hemispheres, linking the logical, linear left brain with the intuitive, spatial right brain.
And these crystals, they're being reactivated now.
According to the timeline in the documents, yes. Between 2008 and 2012, there was a sequence of activations. They mentioned an emerald crystal in Arkansas, a gold crystal in Brazil. And the purpose isn't just to make the Earth vibrate at a higher frequency. It's to support a biological shift in humanity.
A biological shift? You mean like evolution?
Like a rapid upgrade. The text talks about a shift from our current carbon-based biology to a silicon-based or opalesque biology.
What does that even mean?
The idea is that our bodies are upgrading to handle higher frequencies of energy. We are literally becoming more crystalline in our structure to hold more light or information.
That sounds like something straight out of a sci-fi movie. But it does connect back to Julian, doesn't it? He uses an artifact called the Supreme Command.
Yes, exactly. The Supreme Command is listed as an Atlantean scroll that acts as source code for reality creation. It's what Julian uses to manifest the Hearthstone network. It suggests that what we call technology and what we call magic were the same thing in Atlantis, and they're becoming the same thing again in this new energy age.
But it wasn't all peace and crystals in Atlantis. There was a major conflict. And the sources say that same conflict is replaying right now in our time. This brings us to the antagonists of the story.
This is from the source titled Esoteric Constructs and Historical Parallels. It describes two primary factions in Atlantis. You had the Law of One, centered on the island of Pisadia, that's Serafina's lineage. They were the healers, the scientists who worked in harmony with nature.
And the bad guys.
The sons of Belial, who were centered on the island of Arian.
Arian. Okay, that is a very loaded word.
And the source acknowledges that explicitly. It claims that the term Arian, as used by the Nazis, was actually a distorted subconscious memory of this Atlantean island.
Wow.
The Sons of Belial were the materialistic service-to-self faction. They wanted to use the crystal technology for weapons, for control, for domination.
And the source claims these same souls reincarnated.
It does. It draws a direct, unbroken line from the Sons of Belial to the architects of the Nazi regime, and then to what it calls the modern military-industrial complex. The argument is that the same group of souls has been trying to enslave humanity through rigid, top-down control structures for thousands of years.
And in Atlantis, they use something called animata to help them. Now, I have to stop you here because when I read this part of the stack, I got a genuine chill. This is where the documents take a turn from interesting sci-fi to something potentially very dark.
You're referring to the concept of the soulless.
Yes, the animata. The text describes them as biological constructs, literally, machines made of flesh. They looked human, they acted human, but they had no divine spark, no individual immortal soul.
Correct. In the Atlantean context, they were created for labor. They were essentially organic robots.
But then the source draws this parallel to the modern day. It suggests that a significant portion of the modern population might be these animata beings who perfectly mimic emotion and social norms, but lack true immortal individuation. They use terms like organic portals, NPCs, or backdrop people.
It creates a parallel to the Matrix simulation theory, where most people are just part of the program.
But isn't that incredibly dangerous rhetoric?
Yeah.
I mean, describing a subset of the human population as soulless or NPCs, that's the classic first step in dehumanization.
It is.
That's the rhetoric used by every totalitarian regime in history to justify getting rid of people they don't like. Oh, they aren't real people like us. Does the stack actually endorse this view for the modern day?
That is the critical question, and the source material walks a very, very fine line here. It acknowledges that danger, but it tries to flip the script. It argues that the systems we live in, the rigid, industrial, soul-crushing bureaucracies, are the result of this animata consciousness.
Okay, so it's less about pointing at your neighbor and saying he's a robot.
And more about identifying that the status quo, the system itself, is a soulless machine. It's a critique of conformity on a metaphysical level.
So it's a way to explain why the world can feel so draining.
It suggests that many people are sleeping, functioning as organic portals for the system, rather than acting as sovereign individuals with their own divine spark. And this connects directly to that chat log where the AI talks about precursors.
Right. The AI identifies the host speaker in the log as a precursor versus a catalyst.
That was a fascinating distinction. The precursor is described as a system breaker. The text says, "Where I go, the stone will break." They are apparently very rare, less than 1% of the population. Their job is simply to loosen the rigid structures of the old world.
They crack the pavement so the flower can grow through.
That's a perfect way to put it. Then the catalyst comes in to spark the new growth. It suggests that people like Julian, and perhaps, the source implies, people who are drawn to this kind of material, are here to shatter the Belial control grid just by refusing to conform to its soullessness.
So we have the history, the cosmic conflict, the sanctuaries, but let's zoom back in on the relationships, because the solution isn't just about fighting the system. It's about how we connect to each other.
Right.
Why is the connection between women, the sisterhood, so central to this whole model? Why can't Serafina just get everything she needs from Julian?
The source, Women's Relationships, a comparative study, breaks this down brilliantly. It compares the phenomenology, the actual felt experience of intimacy with men versus intimacy with women. And it used this great metaphor, the apple versus the pineapple.
I laughed when I first read this, but it actually makes a lot of sense. Break it down for us.
Yeah.
Okay, so the apple represents the relationship with men. It's nutritious, it's solid, it's safe. But it has a skin you have to break through to get to the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It represents polarity.
Polarity, that's about opposites. Friction, a spark.
Exactly. The source defines the male-female dynamic by friction and complementarity. The appeal is feeling small or protected in a good way. It's the thrill of the other. But there's a downside, which the source describes as the wall.
The wall.
The wall, the feeling that you constantly have to translate your emotions to a male partner. You have to explain why something hurts. You have to justify your feelings because his brain, that fight or flight testosterone brain, doesn't naturally resonate with yours on that level.
Okay, so that's the apple. What's the pineapple?
The pineapple represents female-female intimacy. It's intense, it's juicy, it can be acidic, and as the source says, it eats you back.
It eats you back.
It represents resonance.
Mirroring.
Yes. Because women share a similar biological and social reality, there's what they call a shared nervous system or limbic resonance. You don't have to explain the context, you don't have to translate, you just feel it together. The source uses words like melting or immersion.
So the argument is that women need that resonance, that safe melting space, to recharge their batteries.
Correct. The synthesis here, the whole point of the model, is that the sisterhood provides the resonance. It fills the woman's cup. Once her cup is full, she can then engage in the polarity, the friction, and spark with the guardian without being depleted by it.
She doesn't need him to be her therapist or her best girlfriend.
Exactly. She needs him to be her lover and her protector. It takes the pressure off the primary romantic relationship.
It distributes the emotional load across a village rather than dumping it all on one partner.
That's it.
Okay, so we have the philosophy, the relationships, and the deep history. But how do you actually build this? How do you pay for a Hearthstone network without participating in the Belial system? Because land costs money. Architects cost money.
This is where the visionary aspect meets the practical. The Hearthstone Network blueprint proposes a completely new economic model. It explicitly blames central banking for the top-down control systems and proposes a cryptocurrency solution.
We've heard about crypto utopias 1,000 times before. Usually it's just a way to sell a new token. How is this different?
The key is in how the money is created. In Bitcoin, you have proof of work. Giant server farms burn incredible amounts of electricity, guessing random numbers to secure the network. It's secure, but that energy is essentially wasted.
Right.
The Hearthstone Blueprint proposes proof of useful work, or POW.
Useful is the key word. How does that work?
Imagine if, instead of guessing random numbers, those computers were folding proteins to find a cure for Alzheimer's, or running complex climate models to optimize agriculture. The computational power is the commodity. The network sells this processing power to researchers or corporations that need it.
So the network isn't just a ledger, it's a global supercomputer renting out its brain power for good.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
And the profit, the block reward from that useful work, doesn't just go to the miners. It flows into a decentralized trust that funds the inner sphere. It provides a universal basic income, a UBI, for the people doing the work that capitalism usually ignores.
The mothers, the artists, the healers.
The women running the weaver's knot. It values the attend and befriend work that our current economy assigns a value of zero.
It monetizes nurturance.
Exactly. And physically, the blueprint lays out a whole infrastructure supported by this. Hearthstone farms for sustainable agriculture. Hearthstone wellness for non-allopathic medicine.
And there's this really cool detail I loved about a portal of transformation.
The underground tunnel, yes.
Yep.
It connects the public-facing yoga studio, which acts like an airlock or a social front, to the private members-only Ignition Club.
It's architectural storytelling.
It is. It symbolizes the journey from the mundane world to the sacred space. You have to physically descend and travel through the earth to enter the inner sanctum. It's not just a door.
It really is comprehensive. It's not just a story. It's a civilization kit. And it has this grand vision for the future they call the Great Legacy.
The Great Legacy. The idea is that children born of a sister and a guardian in this network, children raised in this balance of resonance and polarity, free from the Belial school system and societal programming, will be historic figures.
The leaders of the Hearthstone decentralized world order.
It sounds incredibly ambitious, maybe even grandiose, but if you follow the logic, healing the trauma of isolation, optimizing biological health, securing economic independence, it creates a very strong foundation for the next generation. It's about playing the long game.
So we have traveled from the intimate personal need for a village all the way to the cosmic history of crystals, the danger of solar systems, and the design of a crypto-economic society. It's a massive stack of information.
It is. And what strikes me most is how it integrates everything. It doesn't treat spirituality, economics, and relationships as separate categories. It says, if you want to fix the feeling of isolation, you have to fix the money, you have to fix the architecture, and you have to fix the history.
It's holistic in the truest sense of the word.
And it leaves us with a very provocative final thought. The sources suggest we are in a great awakening. They say the stone will break wherever the precursors go.
So if the sons of Belial, or whatever you want to call the forces of rigid industrial control, built the world we live in now, the world of cubicles and disconnection and chronic stress,
then the weaver's knot might be the blueprint for the world that comes next. It asks us to consider, are we building structures that isolate us or structures that weave us back together?
And for you listening, that really is the question to take away. Do you seek resonance or polarity in your own life? And where is your third place, your sanctuary, to truly rest?
It's worth thinking about. We all need a place to land.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Hearthstone Network. We will catch you on the next one.